From Wisconsin Public Radio and Public Radio International, a special series, East Meets West. This hour, Dharma Days, Yoga Nights. It's no secret that Americans like speed. We eat fast food and drive in the fast lane. We like to beat the clock and work 24/7. No wonder we want a break.
In our busy American lives, we need to add a spiritual dimension, a contemplative dimension, a way of calming down and clearing our hearts and minds, the things that prayer and yoga and meditation are famous for.
Americans looking for inner peace have fallen head over heels for contemplative Eastern religions. We've got yoga classes in strip malls, meditation mats in the boardroom. Even our pop music is full of Eastern spiritual insights.
You could see the punk movement being fueled by dissatisfaction, but you could also completely see that this is the first noble truth of the Buddha.
The Beatles did what only the Beatles could have done in such a place. They wrote like madmen. They wrote more songs at the ashram, I think, than at any other point in their lives.
I'm Jim Fleming. In this hour, how Eastern spiritual practices are changing American culture, and how American culture is changing them. Noah Levine talks about his Dharma punk practice. Elizabeth Gilbert describes her adventures in an Indian ashram. And poet Robert Bly shares lessons from India's renowned poet saint, Kabir. There's a long history in the West of pulling up stakes and heading to the East to find a guru, inner peace, or just a dose of spiritual insight. Of course, you can find an ashram in Vermont or a zendo in Indiana, but there's still nothing quite like heading to India to find your soul. Just ask Elizabeth Gilbert. She's the best-selling author of the book Eat, Pray, Love, which chronicles, among other things, her months of meditation and spiritual blood, sweat, and tears in an Indian ashram. She says it was an early midlife crisis, including a messy divorce, that brought her to India to follow in the footsteps of generations of spiritual seekers from the West.
The Greeks and the Romans wrote about sending people to India to find holy men and coming back with ideas from there. For some reason, India has always been this epicenter of scholarly devotional practice. And I feel like I was just another in a, you know, couple thousands of years tradition of people taking pilgrimages to that place.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also had an Indian guru, and you had spent some time with her and meditating before you went over to India. And I guess I'm wondering if you had thought about yourself, say, 10 years ago, could you have ever guessed that that you would have an Indian guru?
I'm sorry to laugh. No. I'm trying to think of a more clever way to answer that question, but quite simply, no. The Indian guru who I, you know, worked with on this journey, and when I say that, I say that very indirectly. This is still a person who I've never met face-to-face, although I was her student during those years, mostly through hearing her speak or reading her books or, you know, following practices that she had suggested.
Even that word, guru, I mean, that has a lot of baggage in this country, really, ever since the 60s. I mean, we've certainly heard all the stories of gurus who may not have turned out to be charlatans, but, you know, they had sometimes shady motivations as well. But you're very upfront about using that word, guru.
Yeah, I decided, you know, call it what it is. But the word, well, it has shady implications here. It has a really rich heritage in India. It means in Sanskrit, the words literally translate as guru, which is darkness, and ru, which is light. And the idea is that this is a teacher who will help you move yourself out of darkness and into light. The first I heard through a friend of mine, the first I saw her photograph and said, who is that, you know, stunningly beautiful, serene-looking Indian woman? And he said, that's my spiritual teacher. And it really was a kind of heart reaction, which is, again, not necessarily something I experience all the time as a very heady person, you know. I'm very driven by intellect and thoughts and words. And it was just this kind of cascading, you know, this sensation of my heart just opening up and something from deep inside my chest saying, I want a spiritual teacher so much. And so I sort of jumped into it.
So here you were, this New York woman. Your life was in a bit of a shambles at this point, and you go off to India. You start settling into an ashram. What was it like there once you got there?
It was reassuringly sane. I would say that was one of the things that I most enjoyed about the experience was that there was very little trace of sort of patchouli-scented nonsense, which as somebody who had just recently lived in Hell's Kitchen, I'm not sure that I could have really taken. You know, one thing that I think is funny was that I went to India with this very predetermined sense of what my teachers in India would look like. They were certainly going to be Indian, you know, and they were going to be real exotic kind of National Geographic looking gurus in orange robes, you know, with ash on their foreheads. And instead, what I discovered at the ashram was that the most compelling teacher that I met was this guy named Richard from Texas, who was a recovered alcoholic / drug user / dealer, Vietnam vet, truck driver from Austin, who was also on this spiritual journey and had been for many years and was there at the ashram and somehow kind of like fell into my path and managed to take all these really esoteric ancient Sanskrit yogic Hindu ideas and translate them for me down to this vernacular of Texas reduction that was so perfect that, you know, like just hit me in a way that I really needed to be reached, you know?
Well, you talk about how rigorous this was. I mean, this wasn't just sort of going off and, you know, listening to nice Indian music. I mean, you had to get up in the middle of the night, you know, before the crack of dawn to start meditating. And meditating is hard work when you do it seriously.
It is. I mean, it wasn't a spa, you know, it wasn't a vacation. It was, you know, it's a monastery. And so it keeps those kind of hours that religious traditions all over the world keep, you know, when you start getting really serious about the soul, which meant getting up at 3:30 every morning, you know. And, you know, I mean, we would have, I'm going to say 4 or 5 hours of rigorous spiritual practice before breakfast. It was hard. It was physically hard, emotionally hard, spiritually hard. And for somebody who, you know, even at that point, after, you know, a couple years of meditation practice and yoga practice, I was still somebody who could not, at that point that I arrived at the ashram, spend 5 minutes alone in her own company in silence without wanting to crawl out of her skin. You know, and so to go from really being unable to tolerate my own presence on earth, which is really what it felt like when I sat in meditation, and I think many people beginning meditation practices feel that way. You know, you start off kind of with high expectations, and then very quickly you become bored, agitated, and full of self-loathing.
So how did you get there? Was it just a matter of time, of toughing it out, of crying when you felt like, you know, you weren't getting it right, and then, you know, somehow getting through to the other side? Or was there a particular breakthrough moment?
There were numbers of little breakthroughs. I mean, a lot of it was about doing it, working on it, and then talking about it with other people who had been doing it for a longer period of time. That's one of the nice things about going into an ashram, is that you're not alone. And I remember once, you know, going in, you know, almost hysterics. I went up to this monk and I just said, I'm so frustrated and angry, and it was 115 degrees out, and it was just, you know, I just thought, what am I doing here? I'm ruining this whole opportunity. And he said, you know, just go sit in the meditation cave, which is what they call it because it's sort of underground and cool. He said, just go sit in there and don't worry about meditating. Just sit, and at the very least, you'll cool off. You know? And I thought that was such a generous thing for a religious scholar to say, like, at the very least, you know, you won't have to sit in this 115-degree sun. And he meant it temperamentally, too. At the very least, you'll settle down a little bit. I wish I could say that there was kind of one radical breakthrough, but I think it's like anything else that you do, you know. And by the time I left the ashram, I could sit in meditation without wanting to assassinate myself for 4 or 5 hours at a stretch. And I would say that's a tremendous transformation in a person's life, to be able to tolerate their own presence on the planet. It's a pretty good start for being able to tolerate, you know, other people, for instance.
Now, was this meditation practice part of what we would call yoga?
Yeah, I mean, yoga in the traditional Indian sense, I mean, here in the West, we've come to sort of narrowly define yoga as, you know, exercise, stretching, classes that you go to.
Being able to twist yourself into a pretzel.
Being able to put your ankle over your ear, you know, that kind of thing. And that's just one limb of what is traditionally in Hindu theology called yoga. Yoga is a word that translates in Sanskrit as union. It comes from the root of the word yoke, you know, the idea that you are yoking yourself to the divine, you know, that you are attaching yourself. And I like the fact that it's yoked like an oxen, which indicates already the work that's involved. You know, it's not a tether. it's not a feathery little connection. You're yoked, you know, which means plowing and pulling and working.
So if really the goal of yoga is this yoking with the divine, this union mm-hmm. with God. How close did you get to God?
Well, you know, the Buddha always said, they tell me, that one must not become addicted to peak experiences along the path of meditation, which was a statement that used to frustrate me because I was like, I would love to have a peak experience to get addicted to. You know, where's my peak experience? I'm not getting that drugged feeling that, you know, other people are talking about. I did have, toward the end of my stay, one of these, you know, something that you could only really describe as an experience of full momentary transcendence that occurred during a very routine session of meditation where, for reasons that I still can't really identify today, though, I suspect that the fact that I had been doing this every day for 3.5 months probably had something to do with it. What they call the veils of illusion, you know, fell from my eyes. And as I sat there, I suddenly, you know, the only way I can say it is I completely understood the workings of the universe. And I didn't just know intellectually that I was part of this divine mystery. I knew it with every cell of my being that I was an intricate and beloved part of a very mysterious and wonderful love, and that I was connected by that love to everybody and everything. And the sense that I had of it was it wasn't sort of dazzling, you know, it wasn't sparkly lights and you know, crazy visions. It was the most serene I have ever felt. And in my reading, the only thing that I can see that approaches it is the way people talk about near-death experiences, you know, when they see that sort of peaceful light and they just feel like it's all so taken care of, you know, there's really nothing to be alarmed at. It's really, there is a plan here and you can relax into it completely. And it seemed sort of amusing to me that I ever would have worried about anything, you know, or that people would ever have any disputes with one another. It just all seemed sort of comic. Like, why, with a love so great, as the poet Hafiz said, are we all not screaming drunks?
Elizabeth Gilbert is the best-selling author of Eat, Pray, Love. She lives, writes, and meditates in New Jersey. She talked to Steve Paulson. While Americans seem to be increasingly taken with a spiritual bounty of the East, it's not always a path of incense and lotus blossoms. In the late 1960s, things were starting to go south for the Beatles. They needed something to bring them together before fame and fortune tore them apart. So along with their wives, girlfriends, and an entourage that included a few big names from the popular culture world, they headed to the ashram of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in Rishikesh, India. It was a move that changed their lives, their music, and American culture forever. Bob Spitz writes about the Beatles' time in India and a whole lot more in his book, The Beatles, The Biography. Spitz told Ann Strainchamps that the ashram was a blissful environment for the Beatles.
It was almost like a little camp. They all had little bunks. They called them bungalows, but they were anything but that. They were more like little barracks. Very stark. And the Beatles immediately took to wearing the long flowing robes and the garb that the Maharishi had worn. And they really loved it quite a bit. It was very, very freeing spiritually for them.
How disciplined was this place? I mean, were they supposed to spend a certain amount of time every day meditating?
They were, and they did. They did to some extent. Ringo fell out very quickly, and Paul got bored and read. But John and George took it very seriously. I mean, they took it more than seriously. John was meditating 6 hours a day. He really felt that he was on some kind of otherworldly spiritual plateau, and it was very freeing for him. And the Beatles did what only the Beatles could have done in such a place. They wrote. They wrote like madmen. They wrote more songs at the ashram in Rishikesh, I think, than at any other point in their lives. Paul couldn't stop writing. The songs were just flowing off of his pen.
Oh, so what songs in particular came out of their time at the ashram?
They wrote the entire White Album there. And they wrote it very quickly. I mean, all those songs came within days of getting there. They couldn't stop. I know that one night they all went down into a village that was down a very steep cliff. And the Maharishi led the way, and everybody in their flowing robes, and there must have been about 30 people, walked behind him, and Paul walked at the back with his guitar, singing a new song that went, "Obladi, Oblada, Life Goes On," which he had just written, and which everybody sang as they walked at dusk down into this village.
Songs they wrote during that time refer to the experiences they were having at the ashram?
Not really. The only thing that came out of it that was from the ashram was Dear Prudence, which was a paean to Mia Farrow's sister Prudence, who was also at the ashram. Mia Farrow was there as well. She had just been divorced from Frank Sinatra, and she was in a pitiful state. In fact, the only person who was in a more pitiful state than Mia at the time was her sister Prudence, who was locked in a room having a nervous breakdown. I think they saw her one or two times the entire time they were there. Otherwise, she was just this spiritual existence in a room that they heard. And so they wrote this song, Dear Prudence, trying to lure her out of her room. And in fact, George and John sang it at the door of her room, trying to lure her out. That was basically all that really reflected their stay there, but all of those songs were of a very definite piece. They all sounded very similar. They all had an edge to them. And I always felt that they were a real release from the craziness of Beatlemania in London just pouring out of them by the time they got to this blissful little corner of the world.
Do you think all that meditating, all that time spent focusing on some higher ground affected them?
Yes, George especially. I think George grew up there. George was, well, I mean, everyone knew he was the little boy of the Beatles, but George also acted like a little boy up until that time. He was what they referred to as the cheeky member of their group, and he was exactly that. He was a smart aleck and a difficult guy. But when he discovered meditation and he began to look inward, George grew very serious and he grew up quite a bit and his interests expanded.
I look at you all, see the love there that's sleeping.
George had never been a reader before this. He took his marriage very seriously at the time as well. He had been, again, unbeknownst to a lot of people, the runaround of the Beatles, even though he was married to Patty Boyd. And all of that started to change when he left. And I think it was because of meditation. George took it very seriously. In fact, you know, he did all the way up until the end of his life.
So why did the Beatles go home? What made them leave India?
A friend of the Beatles showed up after about 3 weeks. His name was Magic Alex. Magic Alex was kind of a fantasist who had latched on to the Beatles. He was a supposed inventor of things like talking wallpaper or speakers that you could put in your cheeks, all things that never materialized. But the Beatles paid him huge sums of money because they thought he was amusing them, that he would be inventing all these things and they would hold the patents on them. Alex was nothing more than a con man and had found, you know, a great source of money for his cons. Nevertheless, he was a troublemaker too and showed up in India essentially to get the Beatles out of there, to get them back to London where he could prey on them again. And he very swiftly told George and John, the most devout of the Maharishi's followers, that the Maharishi was having an affair with a 22-year-old nurse from America, from L.A., that he was preying on the young girls. And
did he make this up out of whole cloth? Because there had been rumors about that.
He did not. Years later, someone told me, and I know this to be true, that John found out for a fact that it actually happened. And they left. They left immediately. Actually, they stayed up all night. Ringo had decamped early. Ringo couldn't take the food in India, and his wife was afraid of the bugs. Paul left with Jane after about 3 weeks. He just grew bored. He said he'd had enough. It was a good experience, but he was going home. John and George stayed, and it was unclear how long they were going to be there. But when they got the news of the Maharishi's supposed dalliance, they stayed up all night debating whether or not this could be true. George was insisting that it wasn't, and then he began to doubt the Maharishi. And John had said that once George doubted the Maharishi, he knew that they were in big trouble. And they left the next morning. They stomped out. They told the Maharishi they were leaving, but they wouldn't tell him why. And he kept following them, crying in their wake, saying, why, just tell me. And John very famously turned around and said, if you're such a holy man, you'll know why. We don't have to tell you. You already know. And they left. They had one more song to write that they wrote in the car as they were leaving. John wrote a song called Sexy Sadie, but it wasn't at all called Sexy Sadie at the time. It was called Maharishi, and it was not just nasty, but vile.
It was a revenge song.
Oh, it was. It was not just a revenge song. John was devastated. I mean, his heart was broken. He had trusted this man, and he felt like he was getting good spiritual information from him that he intended to use when he got back to London, and now he didn't know what to do. The Maharishi was no different than anyone else in his life, his mother and his father and all the other people, Stuart Sutcliffe, who had abandoned him by either dying or leaving.
How did he come to call the song Sexy Sadie?
Because George insisted they couldn't do that to the Maharishi. Insisted. And so it was their supposed little joke that they would change it to Sexy Sadie, which they just made up on the spot as opposed to Maharishi. And that was the last song that came out of that little time spent in India, in Rishikesh.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done?
Spitz says the time spent in India launched the Beatles into adulthood. George practiced meditation until the end of his life. Bob Spitz is the author of The Beatles, the biography. He talked to Dan Strangeships.
Sexy Sadie, oh, you broke the rules one sunny day. The world was waiting for the lover. She came along to turn on everyone.
Coming up, between 1 and 2 million Americans now consider themselves practicing Buddhists. A look at our new melting pot Dharma next. I'm Jim Fleming, and you're listening to Dharma Days Yoga Nights, part of the special series East Meets West, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Jewish on my parents' side, as I always say, but Buddhist by training and inclination. And I was bar mitzvahed. I grew up in Long Island, New York, in the 60s, which I can vaguely remember.
That's Lama Surya Das, one of the foremost teachers of Tibetan Buddhism in America. As you can tell from the accent, he's a member of what you could call the next generation of Buddhist teachers, those who were not born into a Japanese or Chinese or Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but who grew up as middle-class Americans. Today, they're creating the newest form of Buddhism in the world, American Buddhism. Surya Das was born Jeffrey Miller. He came of age in the late 60s and, like many of his generation, spent a lot of time in the anti-war movement. His interest in Buddhism began on a sunny spring day when one of his best friends was killed at a peace protest.
My friend Allison Krauss, a 19-year-old art student at Kent State from Pittsburgh, running away from the part-time soldiers, the National Guard, who shot the four students on campus that day in May of 1970. So that really turned my head around. Fighting for peace and radical politics didn't seem to be the way. And so I wanted to become peace and find God and wisdom. So I went to the Himalayas.
He stayed there for nearly 20 years, meditating and training as a Tibetan Lama.
I first encountered Buddhist teaching when I was a college student.
Sharon Salzberg, co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, has also played a crucial role in adapting Asian meditation practices to the West.
I was just riveted by two aspects of the Buddhist teaching. One was his completely open, unafraid, unashamed acknowledgement of the suffering in life. And there was the Buddha's completely open invitation to do something about the suffering. So those tools of meditation were very alluring for me. I wasn't interested in Buddhism as a religion or even a philosophy. I wanted those tools.
I know I'm more patient and I'm able to deal with situations better because of the practice, because of minute growths that have taken place over decades of work.
Actor Richard Gere, one of America's most prominent converts to Buddhism.
And it's not like I have to be in retreat year-round, you know, an hour a day, you know, but consistent work can do extraordinary things with your mind and your heart.
This is really a life path that takes a certain training of awareness and heart to be able to come into the present moment, because we're usually so preoccupied.
Buddhist psychotherapist Tara Brock.
I tell people often, even if you can only sit for 5 minutes, that begins to train the heart and mind to be present and to have that kind of power of presence where we can accept what's going on.
Buddhism is in many ways the perfect antidote to Western culture. Living in a world in which we're always forward-moving, always focused on achieving, acquiring, and measuring up, does damage to the psyche. The Buddha's 2,000-year-old message of compassion, acceptance, and life in the present moment is for many Americans like a cool drink of water in the middle of a desert.
What so many people find when they take the time to slow down is that there isn't a lot of happiness in busily running around. When I'm in my productivity busyness mode, I'm much less able to be tender and present with my son, to really appreciate the silhouette of the trees against the sky or really listen to Mozart. I'm on my way somewhere else.
The kind of Buddhism we're describing is sometimes called elite Buddhism. Its main practitioners are affluent white Americans, members of the so-called creative class. Two-thirds of the Buddhists in America are not like this. They're from immigrant families, and they attend Chinese or Korean or Vietnamese temples, as their families have done for generations. But for an increasingly broad section of Americans, Buddhism is attractive because it seems less like a religion and more like a science.
This has nothing to do with Asia. Mindfulness is no more Buddhist than the law of gravity is Italian because of Galileo.
John Kabat-Zinn is the founder of the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School.
I like to think of the Buddha as a kind of world-class scientist, a total genius, who didn't have any instruments for measuring anything other than his own mind and body, and went deeply, deeply, deeply into inquiring into the nature of his own mind. And he left very careful lab notes.
The Dalai Lama might agree. He's famously interested in the connections between Buddhism and neuroscience. And a number of his followers, like the former Buddhist monk Alan Wallace, seem to think of Buddhist meditation as a form of brain science. During the years he spent studying personally with the Dalai Lama, Wallace says,
all I wanted to do is basically go to the lab, and that is go into a meditation hut and just spend, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day meditating. And then I was also seeing, hey, I'm a Westerner here, I'm not a Tibetan, so I started to have to adapt some of these methods for myself as a Westerner rather than as a nomad out at 14,000 feet on the Tibetan plateau.
So how are American teachers adapting Buddhism for this culture?
Well, for example, Buddhists in America sit in chairs. I know that doesn't sound like much, but there are Japanese that will tell you you can't meditate in a chair.
Lama Surya Das.
Buddhists in America are more eclectic. They go to different teachers. In Asia, people were pretty much only a member of one school or one sect. And here we have Jewish Buddhists and Zen Catholic Buddhists and feminist Buddhists. Of course, in America, we have our own opportunities, but also obstacles. For example, in America, we love the new. This fast-paced, speedy mind, instant coffee mind, as I call it in America, wanting instant results, instant gratification now.
And that's the big question. When you can Google for a list of top 10 Buddhist celebrities, which includes Richard Gere, Tina Turner, Orlando Bloom, Kate Bosworth, and Tiger Woods, well, then you have to wonder whether Buddhism in America is just the flavor of the moment.
Yeah, or is it just Davy Crockett, you know, coonskin caps all over again, or hula hoops, you know, because Americans get into fads very, very easily. I do not think this is a fad. I think that this is a deep transformative current in our society.
Jon Kabat-Zinn. How might Buddhism transform America? Well, American Buddhist teachers like Surya Das are currently reminding their students that yoga and prayer and meditation are all very well, but that the Buddha also preached a message of positive action in the world, and that how deeply Americans take Buddhist wisdom to heart will be revealed by what we do with it.
What's the overall impact on the quality of your life, your emotions, your way of engaging with other people, dealing with adversity? Is it helpful? Are you more engaged with reality? If it doesn't, then I say meditation is merely a hobby. If it does, then meditation can be something very core.
The way we treat ourselves is the way we treat each other. And if we were to make friends with our own inner life, we would naturally be less judgmental and more compassionate towards the people around us. And I think that extends in a more global way.
May all beings everywhere, with whom we are inseparably interconnected, may all be awakened, liberated, healed, fulfilled, and free. May there be peace and an end to war, violence, poverty, injustice, and oppression. And may we all together complete the spiritual journey all the way to enlightenment.
You know that Buddhism has achieved acceptance in mainstream American pop culture when you find Buddhism jokes on the internet. Why don't Buddhists vacuum in the corners? Because they have no attachments. What is the name of the best Zen teacher? M.T. Ness. How many Zen Buddhists does it take to change a light bulb? None. They are the light bulb. How many Zen Buddhists does it take to change a light bulb? 3. One to change it, one to not change it, and one to both change and not change it. And my favorite. What did a Buddhist say to the hot dog vendor? Make me one with everything. Some things in this world just don't make sense together. Take the silent, meditative spirituality of Buddhism. It has nothing to do with this. Well, Noah Levine thinks punk rock and Buddhism make total sense together. He's even got a name for it, Dharma Punks. Dharmapunks is also the name of his new memoir. And Strange Champ spoke with Noah Levine to find out more.
So what is a Dharmapunk?
I think that the definition that I would use is somebody who's committed to both spiritual practice and rebellion.
Don't those two sort of contradict each other?
I don't think so, actually. I think they go hand in hand. Spiritual practice and rebellion, to me, don't seem like they have any contradiction at all. Actually, I believe that spiritual practice in itself is a form of rebellion. The spiritual path is rebelling against humans' tendency towards war and towards confusion and towards greed and the misidentification with pleasure or material accumulation with true happiness or liberation.
And what about the punk path?
And the punk path also sees clearly that happiness is never going to come from the confused political, social situation we have in the world. And it rebels against all of the oppression and ignorance and all of the isms, the racism and the sexism and the classism. And so in so many ways, you know, the punk rock anti-establishment ethic and the deep spiritual commitment to social and personal transformation go hand in hand.
Hmm. Tell me something about how you began on this path that wound up pulling the Dharma and punk rock together. I mean, how'd you first get drawn into the punk rock scene?
Well, when I was young, I was suffering, shall we say. I was having quite a hard time adjusting to, I don't know, being human, to being incarnated, to being in my family. And I was quite a little rebel-rouser hooligan anyways. I was getting in a lot of trouble. I was, you know, stealing and lying and acting out quite a bit, you know, as a young adolescent, kicked out of elementary school, all of that stuff. When I was 10 years old, I met a really close, you know, kind of best friend. And he had an older cousin who was probably about 13, who was a punk rocker. And this is in 1981.
Hmm.
And one night we were going out to a movie, to a surf flick, and he put on this tape. It was the Sex Pistols. The song that I remember hearing was God Save the Queen, and especially the part where it started saying, no future. There's no future for you. There's no future for me. I really could identify and really feel like, yeah, there isn't. You know, what's the future in this confused world for any of us? My rebellion and my desire for freedom and escape and dissatisfaction led me to a place of total nihilism, of not caring at all and justifying all kinds of harmful actions that led to several incarcerations and finally to a bottoming out on drug and alcohol, addiction and abuse. And being locked up, looking at my third felony arrest at 17 years old and being terrified, you know, and really that being the most traumatic experience where it was like, I'm going to spend 25 to life in prison, you know, for this stuff. And it's not even working. It's not bringing any happiness. It's not bringing any freedom. I'm not a revolutionary. I'm a junkie.
In the book, you describe this moment. You were in jail again and really scared and, you know, whacked out on all kinds of drugs, alcohol. And you called your dad and he yet again talked to you about meditation and suggested that it was the one thing that might help you feel better. What was it about meditation, do you think, that sort of turned you around?
Well, of course, I'd heard about meditation a lot, grew up with it, was completely disinterested, associated it then and still do to some level with some pacifist, hippie, unrealistic ideal or some Asian mystical ideal. So I was quite resistant, but I was in so much pain and I really had exhausted all other avenues or, you know, places to look for satisfaction or happiness that I finally accepted, okay, I'll try this meditation with a lot of skepticism. But through the direct experience of mindfully breathing in and feeling the breath, one breath at a time, the relief that I experienced through being in the present rather than in the past with the guilt or in the future with the terror was so subtle but incredibly profound. Knowing that, you know, for the first time in my life, I saw, wow, it's actually possible not to stay stuck in what the mind is saying or doing. That it's actually possible to redirect the attention to the breath, to the body, to the present moment, and alleviate some of that mental and emotional anguish.
You know, what I find so interesting about your story is that up until now, it's not that unusual a spiritual trajectory. You know, there's the person who's in the world and who's suffering terribly and does a lot of bad things and finally hits bottom, finds a spiritual path, and it pulls them out. But usually they leave their old life behind. What's really interesting to me is that you adopted the spiritual practice, but you're still going out to punk rock clubs and slam dancing.
Sure. You could see the punk movement being fueled by dissatisfaction and expressing that dissatisfaction in an aggressive way, sometimes as anger, sometimes as unity, as, you know, call for the revolution, as pointing out all of the ignorance in the world, in ourselves, in each other. But you could also completely see that this is the first noble truth of the Buddha. The Buddha's first teaching, first noble truth, the nature of human existence is dissatisfactory. It's the same thing that the punks are screaming about. Exact same foundation. And so you can see it as ignorant anger, or you can see it actually as fierce wisdom.
Noah Levine is the author of the memoir called Dharma Punks. And Strange Champ spoke with him. Next, the wit and wisdom of a 15th century Indian poet and saint, translating Kabir for the 21st century. I'm Jim Fleming. You're listening to Dharma Days, Yoga Nights, part of the special series East Meets West, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Americans looking for spiritual insight are finding it in the words of a 15th century poet-saint from India. His name was Kabir, and his words are very nearly timeless. Kabir was a man of enormous wisdom and sharp humor who wrote some of the world's greatest ecstatic poetry. The American poet Robert Bly has retranslated some of it, putting Kabir's insights into the language of our own time and place. He told Steve Paulson that Kabir writes over and over again about the longing of the soul for the divine, which he refers to as the inner lover, or guest.
Friend, hope for the guest while you're alive. Jump into experience while you're alive. Think and think while you're alive. What you call salvation belongs to the time before death. If you don't break your ropes while you're alive, do you think that ghosts will do it after? The idea that the soul will join with the ecstatic just because the body's rotten? That's all fantasy. What is found now is found then. And if you find nothing now, you will simply end up with an apartment in the city of death. If you make love with the divine now in the next life, you will have the face of satisfied desire. So plunge into the truth. Find out who the teacher is. Believe in the great sound. Kabir says this, when the guest is being searched for, it's the intensity of the longing for the guest that does all the work. Look at me. And you'll see a slave of that intensity. So you can get the feeling of them, can you?
Yeah, yeah. And I love that poem because, for one thing, you know, for a guy who is deeply religious, he certainly isn't shy about undercutting a lot of the conventions of religion, sort of doing away with all of the reverence for the afterlife in that one.
He blows all that out immediately. there's always something outrageous in him and something very, very vivid. So, you know, I was reading it one time with a younger poet. We were driving through Chicago, and we came to the point, what is found now is found then. And if you find nothing now, and the young poet rephrased the next line, you will simply end up with a suite in the Ramada Inn of Death. I've been in there many times. But, you know, that's what people love about him, that he can, he goes way out and then comes right way back down again.
And he also talks a lot about the importance of experience. I mean, my sense is that he, I mean, if you sort of had to choose sort of understanding things at an intellectual level or experiencing things just with intensity, he would definitely go for the experience.
Oh, yes, definitely. And another thing that's interesting about him is that he's aware that we know about an inner lover when we're quite young. And you can see that in the faces of children sometimes. And so the question is, how come you lost that and now all you do is read newspapers? He has a poem about that. Shall I give it to you?
Yes, please.
I talk to my inner lover and I say, why such rush? We know that there's some sort of spirit that loves birds and the animals and the ants. Perhaps the same one who gave a radiance to you and your mother's womb. Is it logical you'd be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is, you turned away yourself and decided to go into the dark alone. And now you are tangled up in others and have forgotten what you once knew. And that is why everything you do has some weird failure in it. Whoa.
So why do we do this? Why do we lose our inner lover as we get older?
I would say that you decided to go into the dark alone. You decided that you were a brave person and you were not going to get fooled by any of the religious people. And you're just going to go and become a criminal. No, that's not right. You decided to go and become a business person. No, that's not quite right. You decide to become an idiot. That's more like it. The truth is you turned away yourself and you decided to go into the dark alone. That's wonderful, isn't it? At about 16 or 17, that decision is often made. But I would say that that there's something in us that remembers ecstasy as a child. And then you go to high school. Well, that's it. Or then you go on to the university. That's it. You understand me, do you?
That's a fascinating perspective, though. I mean, basically, the ecstatic experience is something the children have. It's kind of weeded out of us by the time we grow up.
To be sophisticated, most people think, means that you get rid of any ecstasy you have. From the Indian point of view, that's just becoming stupid. The seriously adult person is the one who is kept in touch with the ecstasy that he had as a child. And give you another poem?
Sure.
Have you heard the music that no fingers enter into? Far inside the house, entangled music. What's the sense of leaving your house? And the house here is the same as the body, huh? Have you heard the music that no fingers enter into? Far inside the body, entangled music. What's the sense of leaving your body? Suppose you scrub your ethical skin until it shines, but inside there's no music, then what? I mean, he's talking about the ethical types we have, you know, and around the people around the Puritans. And suppose you scrub your ethical skin until it shines, but inside there's no music, then what? Muhammad's son pores over words and points out this and that, but if his chest is not soaked dark with love, then what? He's talking about the Muslims of his time. And the yogi comes along in his famous orange. But if inside he's colorless, then what? Oh, that's very witty, isn't it? Kabir says, every instant that the sun is risen, if I stand in the temple or on the balcony or in the hot fields or in the walled garden, my own Lord is making love with me.
You know, it strikes me that, I mean, that's a poem that could have been written last year.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, I began this because I found the old translations, but they were in such dopey English that I thought, we can't do this. We can't destroy this thing by having it in the sort of academic English. So my main job was to leap out of academic English and go into a kind of language that is American in the sense of its wildness. And it was just an experiment on my part.
If there was one Kabir poem that everyone in the world could hear, could there be one that could change the world?
They can all do it. But if you're asking me for one poem, I think is what you're doing.
Mm-hmm, I am.
Is that right?
Yep.
Well, all right. I laugh when I hear that the fish in the water is thirsty. You don't grasp the fact that what's most alive of all is inside your own house. And so you walk from one holy city to the next with a confused look. Isn't that in the 60s? Everyone was, I think I'll go to India now, and I think I'll go to Tibet. You don't grasp the fact that what's most alive of all is inside your own house, and so you walk from one holy city to the next with a confused look. Kabir will tell you the truth. Go wherever you like, to Calcutta or Tibet, if you can't find where your soul is hidden. For you, the world will never be real. I like that one pretty well. Between the conscious and the unconscious, the mind has put up a swing. All earth creatures, even the supernovas, sway between these two trees, and it never winds down. Angels, animals, humans, insects by the million, also the wheeling sun and moon, ages go by, and it goes on. Everything is swinging, heaven, earth, water, fire, and the secret one slowly growing a body. Kabir saw that for 15 seconds, and it made him a servant for life.
Robert Bly, reading from his collection of translations called Kabir, Ecstatic Poems. Bly is one of America's best-known poets and writers, and the author of many books of his own. He spoke with Steve Paulson. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Dharma Days, Yoga Nights, is part of the special series East Meets West. It was produced by, to the best of our knowledge, at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information about To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, head to our website, ttbook.org/eastmeetswest.
PRI, Public Radio International.